Great to be here with you all. Thank you for the hospitality today. I appreciate it. It's always good to get down to Princeton. We've been talking a lot about Sean. Obviously, since we got here, Sean is a huge supporter of ours at KET and is really integral to everything that we do there. We appreciate you, Sean, so much. I grew up in Louisville. I didn't know about Princeton until I went to college, and then I got to Western, and it seemed like everybody that I ran around with was from Princeton. One of Princeton's favorite sons, D.G. Sherrill, is a fraternity brother of mine. I texted him yesterday and told him I was going to name drop him at the meeting today, and he got a big kick out of that, as well as Dr. Claudia Cotton with Daniel Boone National Forest. Claude's a good friend of mine as well. Found out that the two of them were the king and the queen of the 1984 Caldwell County homecoming. So it's funny, a small world as it develops that way. So, but again, I appreciate the chance to come to you today to tell you a little bit about the show that I work on KET. It's called Kentucky Life. We just wrapped up our 30th season, which we're really proud of. We air on Saturday nights at 8 o'clock, 7 central, on the main KET channel. And like to get out and kind of meet with groups like this to tell you a little bit about our show and encourage you to check it out sometime. Through the course of this presentation, I'm going to tell you a little bit about myself and how I came to be at KET, some of the adventures we've gotten to have along the way, some of the trips that we've gotten to make to Princeton to highlight Princeton on our show, and tell you some of the fun stories that we work on as well. So from my perspective, again, I grew up in Louisville, went to Pleasure Ridge Park High School, and back in 1983, our principal bought what was one of the first consumer camcorders. For those of you who are in my age range, you remember camcorders. It was a camera that was on this shoulder, and then you had a big cable that ran over to a record deck that was on your other shoulder, and it was a big to-do. Pretty much every school now has a TV station, but back in 84, this was a big deal. There were seven of us that started a little TV station there, and I'm really proud of this. Six of us went on to work in radio, TV, and communications. Five of us are still doing it to this day, some 40 years later. So it really did stick for us. But when I was there at PRP working on this, we got a call from KET one afternoon asking if they would send some students to do this show called Youth News. It's a 15-minute newscast that you could do if you were at a high school in Kentucky. So we decided to go. It was the very first time I'd ever walked into a television station in my entire life, and this happened.
Good morning and welcome to today's edition of Youth News. My name is Chip Holston, and I'll be your host for this afternoon's telecast. Today's program is being produced by students from Pleasure Ridge Park High School.
Bet you never knew a kid from a trailer park in South Louisville had an accent like that, which was the first thing I thought of when I saw that. I walked out of the studio that day. I turned to my buddy Keith, who was on my right, and I'll never forget it. I said, "Keith, I think I just heard the angels sing." When that tally light went on that camera, it changed my life, and I knew that's what I wanted to do. So I went to Western. I was a broadcasting major there. I worked in radio and TV news long enough to know that news probably wasn't going to be where I wanted to go, and I wanted to go a different direction. So I started working in marketing and communications, but I freelanced a lot in Louisville. I did a lot of side gigs, on-air commercials, different things like that. And it's funny how when you look back at your life, there's typically a series of coincidences that all come together that when you look at it in sum, it really did form the direction of your life. And that's exactly what happened to me. And mine started on a weekend when there was a Van Halen concert in Louisville. Now, this was the Sammy Hagar version, not the David Lee Roth version, okay? So Van Halen came to Louisville, and I had some friends from college who came in to go to the concert with us that weekend. The concert was on a Saturday night. That Sunday, one of the guys was looking through the classified ads in the newspaper. You remember when that was a thing? I never looked at those ads, but my buddy Sean was going through the ads, and he started laughing because he came across this ad. The Kentucky Lottery was looking for somebody to host their nightly drawing show. They wanted somebody to stand behind the machine and pull the lever and turn the numbers three nights a week and announce what the winning numbers were. We all thought this was the most hysterical thing we'd ever heard about, and we dared each other. Everybody had worked in communications. We all dared each other to apply for the job because we wanted somebody just to get to the audition stage. We wanted somebody just to at least be able to try out for it, because to us, this was the most cheesiest job that you could possibly ever have in television. which means I got it. And so I spent the next 10 years three nights a week as the good night and good luck guy. And as I'll show you a little bit later, I have the worst poker face in the world. And this was taken the first night that I ever did a drawing. And I look at this picture and I see 24-year-old me scared out of his wits because we were getting ready to go on with our first lottery drawing that night. But I ended up doing it there for another 10 years. The drawings were produced at WKPC-TV in Louisville. Louisville used to have its own PBS affiliate. So there was KET, but then Louisville had a standalone. The lottery drawings left WKPC a few years later, and evidently we were what was keeping the place afloat, because shortly after we left, the station decided they were going to turn the license in and they were going to shutter the station. But KET stepped in and said, you know what, and this was a pretty big deal at the time, we've got KET, but let's set up KET2. And that's what the old PBS affiliate in Louisville ended up being. You've probably seen KET2 with some of the alternative and different programming that we provide there as well. So all the folks that I knew that worked on the lottery drawings were now KET employees. I'd worked with them quite a bit and ended up continuing to work with them and did a show on KET called Mixed Media. I did 5 seasons of this show back in the day. I was showing this to one of our younger coworkers the other day, and he couldn't believe the set for this show. That if somebody had actually built, it's kind of hard to see on the screen here, but somebody had actually built all that stuff there. TV sets now are TV monitors that you put graphics on. But somebody had actually built out all this with the street light and the arches and everything. It was a beautiful set. But did that for another 5 years and then went to the Kentucky Lottery full-time for 20 years, where I ran the communications department there until I came to KET about 2.5 years ago. So that's kind of how I came into the KET family. It all started with that Van Halen concert, and I'm really happy, of course, that they all came into town that weekend. So along the line, we've been able to have some amazing adventures on our show. And I tell people that I get paid to go have adventures for a living, that I get to experience and do a lot of fun stuff. And this last season was a lot of fun, because we spent the entire season looking at the 100th anniversary of the Kentucky State Park System. So we have 16 episodes in a series. 15 of our 16 episodes were done in Kentucky State Parks. And so I got to go some places and have some really amazing experiences. One of my favorites was here at Cumberland Falls State Park. We're in that red boat down there. And there is an outfitter now that will take you up to the edge of the falls. You are literally, you can reach out and touch the water if you want to. You start on the right side and then you come across the front there, as you can see, and get to experience it from the other side. And I'm telling you, the sound and the fury and the energy of that water is unlike anything I've ever seen before. One of my favorite shots from the story right there. I mean, look at that. I had the blue helmet on back there in the back. And you come right up to the water and it really was amazing. After you do this, you go whitewater rafting that you'll see here in just a second. Now, Kentucky's not Colorado or West Virginia, but we do have some nice whitewater through here in town. So we whitewater rafted on the way out. Our videographer is on this boulder. You can see him sitting right there. We kind of run into him a little bit. But again, that was a really fun day, and we really did enjoy that one a lot. Our first day of shooting for this season, I like to tell people we were at Pine Mountain State Resort Park. This was my commute to the office that morning. We were on a place called Chained Rock, which if you've ever been there before, it's a remarkable site up there. But literally, this was how we had to get to the shoot site that day. We were climbing up this rock. And you can kind of see, I've got my head down because I'm looking where I'm going and everything. And one of the most remarkable sights I've ever gotten to enjoy, as I climbed up this rock and I got to the top and I finally stood up. And when I stood up, this is the view that unfolded in front of me that morning. Our state park system is full of treasures like this, and if you haven't gotten to get out and really experience them before, I encourage you to do so, because sites like this were something that we came to see a whole lot of over the course of our season. In the 2.5 years that I've been working on the program, we've been fortunate to be in Princeton several times, so I always look forward to getting here. We actually did an entire show at the Adsmoor, which I'm not saying this because I'm here with this group today, but is one of the most amazing resources that I've come across in the state of Kentucky. The setup here and the way that the house is put together and the people who work there are amazing. We always laugh. When we were shooting this show, you know, there's that busy 2-lane road that runs right in front of the house there. And we needed to do a shot in the front of the house, but traffic kept coming by and we couldn't get it to stop. The wonderful folks there at Adsmoor, there were 4 ladies there who were dressed in these antebellum costumes who were there to kind of help us out throughout the course of the day. We mentioned to them, you know, we're having trouble getting this shot because of traffic. And before we knew it, they are out in the middle of the street.
Of course, it's Princeton.
Stopping.
Yeah, it's okay.
And one of them jumped in front of this semi. And I've often thought this guy was probably randomly driving through town and got home that night and said, I think I saw this today, but I was in Princeton, Kentucky, and this lady dressed from like the 1800s was in the middle of the road stopping traffic. You know, I've often wondered what he thought about that, but we had a fantastic time there that day. And then we went back for a story I'll share with you here pretty quickly about something that I'm sure all of you all are familiar with, but this was our interpretation of it.
Our final story takes us to Princeton, Kentucky, a city known for beautiful homes, so steeped in rich history. But while many of these homes hold wonderful memories of Christmas celebrations and birthdays and family gatherings, there is occasionally the memory of a gathering that was not so wonderful. Specifically, one night there when tragedy struck the community. In the early evening of December 2nd, 1906, city leaders of Princeton, Kentucky, gathered together at the home of Robert Garrett to discuss violence that had occurred in their town the night before. Violence that would spread to other cities in the region. Now known as the Adsmore Museum, Garrett's refined home seems an odd setting to discuss angry farmers wearing hoods and costumes, rampaging through the town and burning buildings, starting what would be known as the Black Patch Tobacco Wars. They called these raiders the Night Riders.
The Night Riders had come into town, had blocked the roads into town and out of town, had taken control of the law enforcement, the telecommunications. So the town was shut down while they did their business, and their business was to burn the tobacco warehouses that were loaded with tobacco to be sold to Duke Tobacco.
The Night Riders had grown from a collection of farmers in western Kentucky and Tennessee, a tobacco-growing area known as the Black Patch region.
The limestone content in the soil is especially conducive to growing certain types of tobacco, and the tobacco that it was especially good for was the tobacco that you would see hanging in barns being smoked, and hence this area was known as the Black Patch.
The Black Patch farmers officially had organized as the Planters Protective Association in an effort to control the supply of tobacco being sold to tobacco companies.
Back in the early 1900s, tobacco was mainly controlled by the Duke Tobacco Trust out of North Carolina. That was James B. Duke. He bought most of the tobacco. He set the price, or his company set the price of the tobacco. Well, he had a monopoly on the tobacco, so he was paying less and less for tobacco, and it got to be where the farmer, when he sold his tobacco, did not even make enough to recoup his cost of producing the tobacco.
Not all farmers joined in, and the initial anger of PPA members toward tobacco companies turned to the non-participating farmers and their families, destroying crops and fields to prevent their tobacco from going to the large companies.
But then it got to be where that wasn't working, so they said, okay, we've organized militia-like. We are going to raid various towns when we know that their tobacco warehouses are full of tobacco, and we're going to burn them. We are going to, you know, diminish the supply of tobacco so that they're going to have to pay us a reasonable price, and then we can sell our tobacco.
Dr. Thomas Amos of Princeton became leader of the Night Riders, and he led the military-style attacks, first on Princeton, then on Hopkinsville, and finally Russellville. And during the attacks, Night Riders would wear face coverings to keep their identities secret.
It was not Ku Klux Klan at all, even though they both maybe wore some type of a face covering. The face covering could have been a feed sack, it could have been a pillowcase, it could have been some, you know, cloth wrapped around their head. It was a variety of things. Mothers and daddies, men and women, will do almost anything if their family is hurting. And that's what happened. Families were hurting, and they didn't have an answer, and they tried to handle it the best way they could.
Eventually, Kentucky Governor Augustus Wilson would send troops into the region, fulfilling a campaign pledge to stop the violence that had captured the nation's attention. This government presence to stop the violence would combine with anti-monopolistic court rulings that would end large tobacco companies controlling the price of tobacco, allowing farmers to see more money for their product, reducing their anger, and eventually bringing about the end of the Black Patch Tobacco Wars.
So that's kind of the type of story that we get to tell. That story is almost 6 minutes long. If you watch a story on television when you get home tonight on a newscast, those are about 90 seconds long. So we've got a lot more time to be able to go in depth to tell you more about a situation. It's not all heavy historical things like that. We have a lot of fun with a lot of different things, like I'll show you here in just a second. But I really enjoy being able to tell stories like that, especially for folks. My mom, 85 years old, lived in Kentucky her entire life, had never heard of the Black Patch Tobacco Wars, and she got fascinated by the story, read up some on it after she saw that. So it's something that really is a lot of fun. Some of the favorite things we've gotten to do, well, we've had some amazing adventures along the way. This was a really cool place. This is an abandoned limestone mine that's right across from the Red River Gorge. It's kind of hard to see with the lighting here, but they have flooded this cave from a natural spring, and you get in these kayaks that are clear. They're clear lucite, and they have LED lights on the bottom of them. So they light up the water as you're kayaking through this abandoned limestone mine. And you saw some fish there a minute ago. There's carp that have been integrated into the area there. They never get fished. They have no natural predators. So they swim right up to your boat and are looking for food and everything. It really is interesting. If you ever are down in that area and get a chance to check it out, be sure you do it. The two things I always tell our producers that I will not do on a story is anything involving heights and snakes. Those are my two. Now, if I ever run into a snake in a high place, I'm in bad shape. But we went to go do a story on the aviation program at Eastern Kentucky University, which is really remarkable. If you haven't heard of it before, the university owns more than 40 aircraft that students get to fly. And we started the day in some flight simulators, and that was a lot of fun. And then we went to the airport. And they wanted me to go up in a plane with a young man who was there, who literally, as we were taxiing out, I realized was younger than both of my children, who was going to be taking me 6,000 feet up into the air in this ramshackle little airplane. So, as I told you earlier, my tell is my face, all right? So here, when we're getting ready to take off, I want you to watch my face, because I kind of go from being, hey, this is really cool, as you'll see, we go out, so I'm like, hey, this is great. And then it's like, holy crap, we're really getting high. And it just, yeah, it really went downhill from there. We were supposed to be in the air for 45 minutes. We were up for 14. And it was extraordinarily windy that day. And this kid, and he was a kid, kept trying to get me to take the controls of the airplane. And I know it doesn't look like it's moving that much, but to me, he was doing this the whole time. And it was a lot of fun. Only time my mom has ever gotten mad at me for doing a story was on this one, because she called and yelled at me and said that that airplane only had one engine, and if that engine had gone out, you would have crashed. So I promised her I wouldn't be going up in any more airplanes again. Another thing I got to do, and I'd wanted to do this since I was a kid, this is the World Championship Dainty Contest in Louisville. Dainty is a game played by Irish immigrants. You've got a long stick there with a short stick that's tapered at the end. You put the short stick on the ground, and then you use the big stick, and you have to knock it up in the air, as you'll see here, and then hit it as it's up in the air. I'd watched this on TV growing up for decades as a kid in Louisville, and during practice, at one point, I actually hit the dainty. You cannot imagine how excited I was when I hit that stick, felt cocky, went to the actual dainty competition here, and then just really choked horribly. But I got the video of the one that I did get to do, so I was all good there. A story that we did that I was not, and I always look forward to every one of our stories, but one that I was not looking forward to, and I saw it coming closer and closer on the production calendar, was one that was going to be set in the tiny town of Carcassonne, Kentucky, which is way up in the mountains of eastern Kentucky, at an old settlement school there that hosts the oldest continual community square dance program in America. They've been doing this for well over 100 years there. My aunt and uncle, when I was a kid, used to square dance. And I remember they had the fancy costumes and the collar, and they were doing all this different stuff, and they wanted me to square dance in the story, and I'm not a dancer, and I'm watching YouTube videos about square dancing, and it's just blowing my mind, and I'm thinking they're all going to be dressed in all of this weird stuff, and I don't have the clothes. So I really didn't know how it was going to go. So we got there to Carcassonne, and we came across some of the sweetest, most wonderful people I've ever encountered. Nobody dresses up. The collar teaches you about three or four steps before you get ready to go, and then everybody just circles up and does it. And it is one of the sweetest evenings I've gotten to spend. Now, here in just a second, you're going to see a lady. She's got a black and white T-shirt on. I'll point her out to you. She's right, as soon as this guy moves, yeah, right over here. Her name is Rose Ballard. She's 85 years old. She drives 4.5 hours each way once a month from Ohio to come back to this square dance, and Rose and I danced the entire night together and had a ball. So something that I had not looked forward to ended up being a lot of fun. Another story that was a lot of fun was when we went to, it's kind of difficult with the darkness here, we went into Mammoth Cave, way back in the cave where people typically aren't allowed, to see Civil War graffiti. This is graffiti that was put on the walls. Some of it was done by oil lamp, some of it was done with pencil, that was done back in the 1880s, 1870s, and because of the temperature control back there, it looks exactly like it did the day that it went on there. And it was one of the coolest things that I have gotten to see. And when we were back there crawling around, the guide that we had with us, he said, look behind that rock over there. And I went behind this rock, and I saw this laying there. It was a newspaper. Still, the pages were separated. It looked like if you wanted to, you could have picked it up and pulled it apart and read. It was in pretty good shape. And as I looked closer on the date on it was August 15th, 1887. Somebody had sat this newspaper down in 1887, and there it sat for the last century and a half. And stuff like that just absolutely amazes me. That gives me goosebumps again just to think of it. But the story that has been the most fun to tell was about a thing called the Great Kentucky Horde that we told in our season 29. A farmer somewhere in Kentucky, no one knows exactly where, was out in his field one evening, was digging around in the dirt, saw something shiny, and found more than $4 million in Civil War era gold coins. He went anonymous. He wouldn't do any media. This was covered by the New York Times, the Washington Post. Big media jumped all over the story. He wouldn't talk to anybody. Over the course of 8 months, we were able to convince him to respond to written questions. So he answered questions for us, and it was the first time anybody had ever heard from him. And this is the story that we were able to tell, part of the story we were able to tell as a result.
More than 700 rare gold Civil War era coins were found somewhere in the bluegrass. The coins date back between 1850 and 1862. It's being called the Great Kentucky Horde.
When news of the Great Kentucky Horde broke, it broke big. The story received extensive media attention all across the country, with everyone from the New York Times to the Washington Post to TV news networks covering it. But throughout all of this, one question, a big question, remained. What can you tell us about the farmer? Who is the person that found this?
Well, that was one of the reasons the person came to me. He wanted to, get to know me and talk about, he wanted to do something, but he wanted to stay completely confidential about everything. We didn't want people to, bug him for any reason, or also, dig up his land and things like that. So it's pretty much all, that part's confidential, and I'm just going to remain that way.
But after a couple of months of back and forth, one day I opened up an email to find 3 pages of written responses to questions from the farmer who discovered the Great Kentucky
Horde. I forgot to mention earlier,
these are the only
you're
going to
see video in here in a little bit. As the farmer was digging out the gold, he took out his cell phone and filmed the gold coming out of the ground. You'll see the actual gold coming out of the ground.
I started walking a portion of the property where I had seen broken pieces of pottery and brick, strewn in a fairly confined area, when I came across the first coin, something that has happened a decent amount of times. I found my first old coin when I was maybe 9, walking the fields around my hometown looking for arrowheads. But this time, it was a little more exciting. Little did I know what that would lead to next.
I asked, when you first looked down in the dirt and saw the coins, what was going through your mind? Did you realize the enormity of what you had just found and that this was a life-changing event?
I initially found the 1856 Seated Liberty half dollar, probably 20 to 30 feet from where the hoard was located. I would have never believed what came next. Things that only happen in dreams. When I continued walking and saw the glint of gold, a thick, reeded edge. When I pulled the coin from the ground, I was astonished when I realized I was holding a $20 double eagle from the 1860s. After I flipped the first
actual video
dirt over the next 45 minutes to an hour, the coins kept coming. I knew it was hundreds. I initially guessed around 300 to maybe 400 coins. To my surprise, when I got home and started counting, the total was over 800 coins, 770 of which were gold.
That story's on the KET YouTube channel. Before that story was posted a year ago, the most watched story on that channel had been up for 6 years and had been seen over 600,000 times. The second most watched story had been on for 10 years, had been watched 500,000 times. That story has now been up for 14 months and has been viewed 2.2 million times from people who have been wanting to get more information about the Great Kentucky Hoard. The story took off in a way that none of us ever imagined, and it was so much fun getting to tell this person's story as best we could, because it really just does capture your imagination. As soon as we heard about the discovery, we knew it was perfect for our show, and it took a long time to get it across the finish line, but we finally got it there. So, final thing I'll leave you with, the first day of shooting, when we got everything together for season 30, when we were going to tell the story of our great state parks. You know, the first day of shooting for a new season is a lot like the first day of school. There's a nervous energy. Everybody's excited. Some folks have new shoes. I mean, it's the whole thing that everybody's ready to go, you know. But we got out of town a little late that day. We were trying to get from Lexington to there at Pine Mountain, and we were a little late getting out. We knew we were running out of daylight. We were running out of time, so we were rushing to get there. We finally get to where we're going to go. We jump out of the vans. We grab the gear. We run up to see everything, and we stop dead in our tracks because this is what we walked up to. Just absolutely breathtaking. And it's one of the great things you can see in our state parks and see in our show as well that I encourage you to check out. So if you haven't seen our show before, again, Saturday nights at 8 p.m., 7 Central, would love for you to check it out. If you're on Facebook or social media, you can find me at Chip Polston, KET. I tell a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff and a lot of things about the adventures that we get to go have there that you can check out. I'm leaving here to go on an adventure in Western Kentucky. We are telling the story of the armadillo invasion of Western Kentucky. And we have wanted to tell this story for 2 years, but the only time we could ever find armadillos were dead on the side of the Western Kentucky Parkway. About 8 months ago, we were shooting at Lake Barkley. We had had a 15-hour day. We were exhausted. We checked in at 10 o'clock that night. Everybody immediately got ready to crash, and all of a sudden, somebody's banging on my door, and I come out, and there's 8 armadillos out there digging around. We couldn't believe it. And talked to the folks there, and they were like, oh, yeah, there's a lot here. So we have come back to hook up with the armadillos tonight. So we're I don't want to say shooting armadillos, because I told somebody we were going to go shoot armadillos, and they took it a very different direction. So we're filming armadillos later on this evening, and that's a story that we'll bring you on season 31. So please check out our show. We'd love to have you check it out. And thanks again for your time and attention today. Appreciate you all letting me be here.
Anybody got questions?
Stacy, it's okay to tell us. Is Jeff the one who found the gold coins?
Yeah, we hide it so well.
You know, it was interesting with that because, you know, I spent 20 years running the communications department at the Kentucky Lottery. So I sat at the table with every Powerball winner in Kentucky for 20 years. So I knew where this guy's head was. I know what that's like to have sudden wealth literally fall out of the sky. So I knew what not to do as well as I knew what to do to try to get this guy to talk to us. And I knew it was going to be, you know, this wasn't going to be a week-long thing. This was going to be months of developing trust to get him to where he would converse with us. I tried to get him on the phone with me through the coin broker that you saw there. I said, give me 5 minutes on the phone with him. I won't record it. I'll just take notes. He didn't want to talk. Finally, I said, can we just do written responses? He went back and forth, said no, and we got to a point where we just had to move forward with the story. I called the coin broker and said, thanks, but we're going to have to move on. And 3 hours later, I get an email, and the subject line is, check this out. And it's three pages of responses from the guy about what it was like to stumble across $4 million in Civil War era gold out of the field. And the story, again, really did take off. And it was one of those stories of a lifetime. And I just, I don't think I'll ever get to tell another one like it, but it sure was a lot of fun. So,
do we know if he sold it all or if he's kept some of it?
He sold most of it. He did keep some. And one coin, I was fascinated by this, one of the coins he kept was the only coin that had a very faint imprint of a burlap bag on it. So it was clear, based on the material fragment that they found attached to the gold, that this had been in a bag and buried in a field. And we did an entire episode about this. The whole 30-minute show was about this, where we interviewed a number of historians and Civil War era experts about how that gold got into the ground. And we asked six different people how the gold got into the ground, and six different answers. Everybody had a different theory. Most of them aligned around a group called Morgan's Raiders, if you've ever studied them in school. This was a group during the Civil War that went somewhat rogue and tore through Ohio, Indiana, Kentucky, and Tennessee, looting and pillaging as they went. And they stole so much that they couldn't carry it a lot of times. So they would bury it with the plan to come back to get it someday. Is that how it ended up in the ground? That's what some people think. Other folks think it was a wealthy landowner who maybe heard Morgan's Raiders were on the way, buried it, they were killed in a skirmish, and nobody went out to find the gold again. One interesting aside to it, we went out with these guys called the Dirt Nerds. They go out on weekends to do metal detecting, looking for buried treasure. And when they go to a house that stood in the 1800s, the first thing they try to determine is where the main bedroom was in the home back then. Because what they have found is that if they can go to where that bedroom is and look out the windows and see the view out there, that's where they start searching. Because when people would bury things back then, if they heard something in the middle of the night, they wanted to get up, be able to look out their bedroom curtains and see if anybody was out in the yard messing with anything that they had in the ground. And they've had really good luck starting from that perspective, going out and actually looking for things. So, again, that was a lot of fun to tell. If you get a chance, check it out on our YouTube channel. It really is a great story.
Are old episodes available?
All 30 seasons.
Okay.
Everything's on there. Yeah, KET.org is our website. Go there. Go to TV shows at the top there, and it'll take you right to Kentucky Life. You can go all the way back to the very first episode 30 years ago.
Awesome.
So we've seen your good shows. What was it really, really impressed you? What's the worst?
The worst show. The worst show we did, without a doubt, was a show that we did at Natural Bridge State Resort Park. Not because Natural Bridge is a bad place, but because we shot at Natural Bridge on the hottest day in Kentucky in 12 years. And we were on that sandstone. You know, if you've ever been to the Arch before, there's no shade, there's no relief, and it was miserable. And we had to ride the chairlift. If you've ever been there before, you chairlift. So we had to chairlift all of our gear to get up there. Got up there, got everything shot. We're about halfway down, and a thunderstorm hits. And you're on the chairlift. I mean, you're. What are you going to do? They're not going to stop it. They're going to keep moving it. And so it was a day that went from bad to worse. You watch the show, you would never know it in a million years. Everything looks great. But we were just dying. And it was one of those things where when we decided to go to state parks, nobody really thought, okay, that means you're going to be outside the entire season. So in the summer, we like to shoot in museums and like at Adsmoor. We shot there in the summer because it's air conditioned and we don't have to be out at it. But being out in the elements, that Natural Bridge shoot was one to this day that we all still kind of use as the bar. Was it as bad as Natural Bridge? I mean, that's kind of how we did that. But still a lot of fun. Still a lot of fun. Any other questions?
Chip, it's just nice to meet you. I've really enjoyed your show.
Thank you.
Watching it, and it's just nice to see you in person.
Well, I appreciate that.
And you have encouraged me to go get my shovel.
Well, got to get back to work.
Good luck with that. When you hit it, give me a call, okay? We'll do a follow-up story. I'll look nice forward to it. Nice to meet you as well. I appreciate it.
Chip, I'm afraid a few of us don't meet in our yard.
Yeah. Talked to a metal detector dealer in Simpsonville, Kentucky, who said His phone rang off the hook and his sales exploded after this story went. Now, there's no connection back to metal detecting because from the story we got from the guy, he saw the glint in the ground and went from there. But these metal detecting folks are all, and I can't tell you how many have reached out to me thinking I know where this was, trying to get me to tell them where this guy is. And I'm saying, I don't know. And I didn't ask, and I don't want to know. Because right, if it gets out, I don't want to be on the short list of right. people that let that information get out. But I've had so many people reach out to me, come on, you can tell, where was it? No, let me know where it was. No idea where it was.
I'm just still mad you never picked my lottery numbers.
Well, I almost said that I said I worked for the Kentucky Lottery. I almost apologized that you hadn't won. So I'm sorry about that part. But that was a lot of fun back in the day as well. It sure was.
Do you ever get nervous whenever do you still get nervous?
You know, it's all taped. So it's on tape. So if something messes up, you can go back and do it again, that sort of thing. But there's other things that I do at KET that are live. So, for example, at the end of this month, Kentucky Tonight is our Monday night show at 8 p.m. that's always shot live. I'm doing a live Kentucky's 250th anniversary show with a group of historians from around Kentucky. That's a whole different animal, live TV, because it can go off the rails really quickly. That was where the lottery drawings were such great training for me, because those lottery drawings were 60 seconds long. You had 60 seconds to draw numbers from three different machines, and it was live. So if a machine hung up, if something went wrong, you had to plow through. There was no, you know, hey, can we start this again sort of thing at 15 seconds into it. You just had to go. And that just kind of rewires your brain. So once you do that for long enough, you kind of get used to the whole thing. I'm more nervous doing this than I am, because when I'm out with their crew, it's five or six folks and a camera, and that's it. When I get a bunch of eyeballs like this is when I start to sweat a little bit. So it's funny how different things can make you nervous along the way.
So from an outsider looking in, really looking in, what other than some women dressed in Victorian dresses stopping semis, what's the thing that about Adsmore that you think is the makes it the gem that it is?
It is beautifully preserved. It's clear that the people that work there have an amazing love for the place. And it's just beautiful. You'll find older homes around Kentucky, and we've shot in some of them, that they're nice. They're in okay shape. They're not in great shape. But the Adsmore was just beautiful. And the energy from the people that were there that day with us and the way that the whole thing is set up, it really resonated with me. And our crew will tell you that it resonated with them, because I'm going on to my third year now, and at the Adsmore was only the second time in the almost hundreds of shoots that we've done around the state where the folks at the Adsmore brought in lunch and fed the crew. It's only the second time in 3 years that that's happened. So if you want to talk about making an impression on a crew, you bring them lunch that afternoon, and they're your friends for life. So, but the Adsmore is just, it's a gem unlike a lot of other places that I found in Kentucky. And again, I've gone to a lot of old houses, and they're nice, but that's just next level. And the way the community seems to rally around it, it was a lot of fun, and it really did resonate with me. Good deal. All right. Well, thank you all again for your time. I appreciate it.